My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Walder Hagrids, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, Walder, we're talking about you surviving a crisis. On Monday, I think it was, we were texting, and suddenly I hear news that Spain has some electricity problems, and suddenly you were gone, and you didn't text me back.
Disappeared from the earth, Dario. Yeah, so I was in what the Spanish call a gran apagón, which apagón is not enough, it has to be gran apagón. electricity basically dropped off. All of a sudden we were without any electrical appliances and we were without internet. And that was a fascinating experience, but I also understand that the outside world looked at it very differently from what it was than what we actually experienced. So that might be something that's interesting for us to analyze.
Absolutely. But let's start with the basic facts. So on April 28th, and I think it is important again to say that we're recording this on May 2nd. So we, as of now, do not know what was the actual reason behind this major power blackout, right? Where I think for, at least in Madrid, for about 10 hours, there was no electricity, also no phone service, no internet, nothing, basically. Only emergency, I think, so hospitals had like backups, and I think that the government, I would hope they had some backups. And then like further in the rural areas outside of Madrid, I think it took a bit longer for the electricity to come back, because I mean the priority was Madrid in that sense.
Well, the large cities, yes, but my experience being in Madrid was that it went off around 1:30, I believe it was around there, 1:30 in the afternoon, and it only came back on at around 10:30. So that was, that was a long period of time. Now, there were other places, and we might talk about that, but for example, my mother has a house in the south. And for her, it took until 10 o'clock the following morning for the electricity to come back on. So there were major differences. And of course, the cities get priority there.
I mean, it makes sense, right? Madrid is what, 5 to 8 million people, depending on how I think you count it. Like what you count as part of Madrid, so that's already a good chunk of the Spanish population. So I'm not upset about the fact that Madrid got priority.
It's also just from a strategic perspective, right? It's not just the amount of population, the amount of people living in the large cities, but it's also that large cities are essential hubs for coordinating everything, for making sure that everything works properly again, right? So that is no disrespect to small towns, but if a small town doesn't have electricity, it doesn't affect the rest of the country. If Madrid has no electricity, it affects everyone, right? So that makes sense.
And also when it comes to the economy, right? Because so there's this organization called CEOE, and they estimated that the outage resulted in an economic loss valued at 1.6 billion euros. That's a lot of money, right? For one day. I mean, it kind of sometimes helps you maybe a little bit to visualize how big economies have gotten, that if there's no electricity for basically 10 hours or maybe even 24 hours in some parts of the country, that 1.6 billion euros are lost.
Well, and it shows how much of our economic activity is, of course, completely dependent on electricity. Now, that's not a surprise. Everyone understands this, but it is good to reflect on that, right? Like, there are very few activities, there are very few jobs that can actually function without electricity. Even things such as, for example, street cleaners, or, where you think, hey, you just need a broom and you need to clean the street. But in order to coordinate, in order to get where you need to go, in order to know what your job is for the day, you are dependent on a computer system that assigns you somewhere, right? So there are all these kinds of aspects to it that make us completely dependent. Now, that is not something mind-blowing, but it's still good once in a while to reflect upon.
Well, and it's also international relations consultants such as yourself, right? Because without internet, phone, whatever, you can't research anything and you can't talk to anyone.
It was absolutely fascinating because in my case, I absolutely could just not do anything. There was nothing I could do. Well, I could read a book and I could take some notes with a piece of paper that wouldn't have been very useful because it's not part of my organizational system anymore, notes with paper. But I was actually at some point sitting on the sofa in my living room And I realized that besides just reading or talking to my wife or something like that, there was absolutely nothing professional that I could do that was useful. Which is, of course, fascinating, right? It did remind me a little bit, here I'm gonna pretend that I'm very old, but it reminded me of my childhood, right? In the 1980s, that was what life kind of looked like, that most of the time on a Saturday or Sunday, and you were at home, you could just read a book or maybe watch some TV, but that was it. There was nothing else to do. You weren't checking the internet. It was almost impossible. You couldn't buy tickets online. There was very little other activity. So it was all of a sudden sort of a throwback to how humanity has lived for most of its existence. But we have completely forgotten about that.
Well, let's talk about the initial kind of like moment when it happens. So I've had power blackouts here in Berlin as well, right? And so it was weird because suddenly the light would go out and well, no, it was during the day, so I didn't realize the light was out, but I realized that at some point the Wi-Fi was gone, right? It was also me working here from home, and it was, oh, the Wi-Fi is gone, that's interesting. And your first instinct is, of course, something must be wrong with the router or whatever. And then you get thinking, oh no, I mean, it doesn't even show any electricity. Ah, okay, there's no little light on. And you turn on the light, you're like, oh, okay, seems like the power is gone. Okay. And then my first instinct is to go actually to Twitter, because the Berlin Energy Services are actually really active on there, because it's kind of the easiest platform to post that, oh, hey, in this little part of town, there's currently no electricity. And this happens in Berlin all the time, that for a few minutes, electricity is gone because of whatever, right? Like little human errors usually. But then how is that different when also the internet is gone, so you can't even look up what's happening? I mean, so what was that immediate feeling when the power was suddenly gone?
But this was a curious thing. Someone needs to explain the technical aspects of this to me, because so all of a sudden I noticed exactly what you described, right? I noticed the power was out in my house. So I thought, okay, you first check if it's something about your house, then you notice that in the building it was also off. So I thought, okay, it's a building thing. And then all of a sudden you realize, hang on, it's a bit more than just a building or the house, because in the street people are also acting weirdly. From my balcony I could see it, etc., etc. Okay, so now you know that something else is going on. Your immediate reaction is just, that's a little bit annoying. I'm sure it will come back in 10 minutes or something. But interestingly enough, and this is what I meant with someone has to explain to me how this worked, the internet still worked for me for half an hour on my phone. So computer couldn't use it, anything, but my phone still had battery and the internet on there worked. I assume because there are some generators that keep it going for a while and for emergency things. And so I could actually, I then saw immediately, oh, it's Spain and Portugal. And the first thing I read, by the way, we'll talk about that in a second, is, oh, it's probably a cyber attack. That was the first thing I read on the internet. And my reaction was, really? So I had the advantage of knowing basically that there was an electricity outage. There was no bigger thing as far as we could tell. You know, it was just the power was out, nothing. There was no invasion or anything like that. So that made it much easier for me to deal with it and just say, look, okay, so we'll just have to calmly wait until something else happens. But there were people who actually didn't have that internet connection when it dropped out. And so they were completely in the dark. And then it becomes a very scary situation, right? If all of a sudden you can't do anything in your usual life because internet's off, appliances are off, and you don't have any news to actually give it some perspective, then it's very, very easy to panic. And it reminds me a little bit of people, and this applies to myself in the past, but others as well, who know that, for example, there's something wrong with their body, that something is unhealthy, that something is off, that you're ill in some way, but doctors can't tell you what it is. Not knowing what it is often much worse than the actual diagnosis, right? So once you know, so for example, in my case, this is 20 years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer, but the moment I heard that, it was a relief, because at least I thought, okay, now we can do something about it. Now at least I've got something to work on. Whereas before I was walking around kind of like, what is going on? I just need some answers, right? And I think that is what happened to a lot of people who didn't have that initial internet connection like me. They were mostly panicked because of not knowing, not because of the actual news.
And this is obviously for the listeners who are asking themselves, why are we talking about this? This is obviously the bigger picture. Because last week, in last week's episode, we talked about kind of the growing fear of war within the West, and that we're becoming simply more anxious, right? Things aren't going as well anymore. And so for a lot of people, it basically was worst case scenario thinking immediately. And I mean, I really like the example you gave of health, because of course, if you have something you don't know what it is, your brain obviously starts going into overdrive, going through all the terrible scenarios that it could be, right? And so it was similar, I assume, for some people in Madrid and in Spain at that moment, because, and this is a little bit the outsider perspective now, right? So what I saw, or what the rest of the world basically saw about Spain, is people being stuck on trains, right? So you had some like TV images that still came out. I assume TV stations also have backup generators of sorts. So you see people being stuck on trains and on the metro, but the kind of first images that they really circulated were people panic buying at supermarkets. So people flooding to the supermarkets that still had a little bit of electricity and basically buying like off everything off the shelves, preparing themselves almost for another pandemic. All right. So being like, okay, we've done this before. We've done the pandemic before. So where's my toilet paper? Where's my pasta? And maybe my soap, and grabbing all of that. And I remember thinking, because then from a certain point onwards, you also didn't get any news out of Spain. That, oh, what's happening now in this 10 hours of potential anarchy, right? I mean, will people be fine in these 10 hours? Because we from the outside knew that they said, hey, there's a major like outage. It will take us like 10, 12 hours to restore things to a basic level. Everyone calm down. So from the outside world, right, I calmed down about the state of energy being back in 10 hours. But I was not as calm about, oh, what are people going through right now, right? Are they chill? Are they enjoying themselves? Or are they panicking? And if the last image you see is people rushing to the supermarkets, you think, oh, what's happening when people are starting to fight over the last bag of toilet paper? Will this be fine? You can't really call emergency services. What's happening here?
Yeah, this was the fascinating contrast between you and me, or me and everyone outside of Spain and Portugal, that you had much more technical information about what was going on. We had no information whatsoever. I mean, later people figured out that they could use the radio, but in the beginning, certainly, and I didn't have, at least I thought I didn't have a radio at home. Eventually, it turned out that I did. So you had all this technical information, but I had, and the others here living in Spain, had the social information. And so from the inside, it looked completely different. We had no idea what was going on with electricity, but actually Spanish society was lovely. People were going on the street partying, literally, like, you know, starting sharing food together, not in a panicked way, like, oh, this is the end times, but just like, hey, do you want some of my crisps? Here, I've got still an ice cream. The freezer is soon not going to work anymore. So let's use all the ice cream from my freezer to share with people in the street. In the parks, you saw teenagers who, I think, all of a sudden discovered that you can actually talk to each other rather than sit around looking at your own individual phone. I mean, it was actually really, really nice. I was amazed by Madrid traffic, because I always find Spanish drivers way too aggressive and beeping their horn unnecessarily and, you know, really stressed when they are in the car. Something about at least Madrid drivers is that they become stressed the moment they step into their car. But on Monday, people were so nice. Cars let pedestrians go first. Pedestrians let cars go first, because of course there were no traffic lights. There was hardly any police. There was close by. I live near Bentas, and there was this. There's this very big place where the motorway and an important street cross each other, and it's always full of traffic. There was one policeman trying to manage hundreds of cars, an impossible job, but everyone was trying their best. Everyone was making something out of it, right? So those images that the rest of the world got, sort of negative images, panic buys, in reality, it wasn't at all the case. There were some shops open, most shops closed because no electricity, but there were some shops that stayed up, corner shops that were just dark and you could buy things there. Some supermarkets had sort of some basic generator, stayed open a little bit. And again, everything was incredibly nicely well organized. There was absolutely no panic, there was no stress. People were more like, okay, we'll see what happens.
See, for me, then after a long day of work, right, at night, I'm on social media, and suddenly you start like getting first like videos out of Madrid because electricity is back on, and then you see exactly what you just described, right? It's young people being out in the parks, people dancing, celebrating, right? So like buskers basically popping up everywhere, making music, people having a great, fantastic time, and then suddenly the light goes on and everyone is cheering, celebrating. And I actually had FOMO, right? I actually thought I really could have used this lovely like extra vacation day, right? Of just everyone being out and about. And then I saw a Generation Z, right? All these young people basically posting, oh, this is what the 90s must have been like, right? Without phones, everyone talking to each other and so on, and everyone kind of taking a almost a well-deserved vacation. But I think we should add that this is specifically Madrid. I also did have some like friends on the out, like basically in rural Spain, and some of them said, "Oh, right, we just continued as normal. We were in our house, kind of like doing our thing, and there weren't these celebratory images, basically coming out of the small villages." But like on a whole, I think Madrid passed the emergency check.
Absolutely. No, I think this is also something very specific to, if you like, Spanish culture or maybe Latin culture, depending on how you identify it. But Spain is just, I think it's safe to say, a more sociable country, a more a kinder country in many ways than, for example, the Netherlands or the United Kingdom. I can't really speak about Germany, Dario, but certainly you notice how, for example, in Spain, there's always more respect for intergenerational relations. Old people feel very comfortable in the streets and they don't feel fearful. And it was completely obvious on Monday once again that old people, they were, everyone came to help them if they needed some help. There were old people on benches as there always are, and they got a lot of support. There is something about Spain that already has inherently that kind of social solidarity approach. And then on top of that, the fact that people understood, look, we're all in this together, made it actually, exactly as said, in Madrid at least, very enjoyable. Now, that is not taking away the fact that there were real problems, right? I mean, so if you had an emergency, if you all of a sudden needed an ambulance, you were in trouble. If all of a sudden something went wrong psychologically, or it would be very difficult to get help from the official services, so there would be neighbors helping you, but not the system didn't function properly because there was just not enough police and everyone was confused. So I'm not trying to deny that there were very serious and real problems as a result of it. However, the overarching tone, the overarching vibe in the street was, hey, let's just relax, let's help each other, let's have fun. And that was really, really nice.
Let's move on to the kind of Western bubble big picture. Even like specifically talking about the fact that we are such a fearful society and that first thoughts were about a cyber attack. Right? I mean, it was the same for me. So my mother asked me at night, oh, was this a cyber attack? And I remember thinking, a cyber attack of that scale is really difficult to exercise. A cyber attack of that scale takes a long time to prepare, and why would you target Spain? Like, I mean, then target a real country. Sorry, Spain, but like, I mean, I think you said this too. Spain doesn't have any big enemies out there. Like, if it had hit Germany, I would have said, okay, this maybe makes more sense. But why would anyone hit Spain? But that was our first thought, right? Our first thought, and in the media and everywhere was like, oh, of course, this was the Russians. Russians are hitting Spain.
Yeah, and it was so like I said at the beginning, that was the one of the few news items that I could still read before the internet also went off. And I have no technical expertise. I don't know how difficult it is to implement a cyber attack or not to do what, to make this happen. But exactly as you said, my immediate geopolitical reaction, because that is my area of expertise, was why in heaven's name, if this was some kind of attack, this is a big deal. Why would you actually target Spain? Spain is geopolitically very neutral. Yes, it's in Western Europe, but it has good relations, relatively good relations with Russia, relatively good relations with China, relatively good relations with Iran. There's absolutely no country that would think, hey, I'm gonna organize this enormous attack, and you know who I'm gonna go first? After, it's gonna be Spain and Portugal. No, Spain and Portugal will be the last on the list when it comes to hitting Western Europe. So I mean, it's we still don't know for sure exactly what happens, but I was immediately skeptical. But the media jumped at it, right? Because it is much more spectacular, but it also fulfills our fear syndrome much better if we attribute malice to it rather than just a technical error, just an accident, just a mistake somewhere, or just something going wrong without anyone being responsible. Our psychology demands enemies, and so when something like this happens, immediately we try to find the bad guys who are responsible for this.
And in Madrid, right, people turn on their cars and listen to the radio. So I think at least the way I perceived it, there was a good state of information. You already spoke about your mother living in the south of Spain in a small town, and there you told me an interesting anecdote that it was different because rumors started spreading very quickly, going into a different direction than the information that was out there.
Yeah, so there was immediately this idea of, oh, this is something really bad. This is probably some kind of war. You can see how in small towns it happens much easier than in a city, because in a city, the moment you and your family start talking about war and you stand on the balcony and you see people partying in the street, you think, well, probably not, right? But in a small town, we're talking about literally 2,000 people, not more than that. This kind of dynamic, psychological dynamic, happens much more quickly, also because people just are not necessarily in they're more interested in the rumor and the excitement of it, so they start fanning the flames, they start making it sound worse. And so there was this immediate reaction of, hang on, this is the beginning of the end, this is World War III. That kind of attitude. And that is very problematic for people who then actually really, really worry about that and who stress about that and say, how can I get to my loved ones? Am I ever going to meet them again? Hey, I can't phone them. I can't read the news. What am I going to do? Right? And this is very typical of how our human of how human society often works, that we attribute the events to a bad guy, but we also assume the worst. And based on that kind of foundational assumption, we start panicking and we start stressing and we start thinking the worst thoughts and we can't sleep anymore. And that is extremely dangerous. And that is one of the reasons, there are more, but one of the reasons why the West has been going off such a dangerous tangent over the past years. When it comes to this idea that we're on the cusp of war, that we're almost, it's only a matter of time before Russia attacks us or China attacks us, or during the war on terror, the terrorist bomb us all, right? This irrational creation of bad guys around the world, of evil around the world that is trying to kill us, that is trying to eradicate us, leads to us badly interpreting, irrationally interpreting events like the ones on Monday, with all kinds of potentially disastrous consequences.
So there is people who are basically irrationally interpreting these events, right? And I wouldn't ascribe any any negative intentions with that, right? It's just us being humans, right? It's your first thought is obviously going into, right? I mean, it's also, I think it's very primal, right? Thinking, oh, something has gone bad. Let me immediately cover all my bases. What are all the negative scenarios that could happen, right? And I think that's a very human, like reaction. And in that sense, I could never be mad at anyone who thinks that way. What I do get upset about is the fact that this is immediately being politicized and afterwards in today's world. And maybe I'm too young to remember, and this has always been the case. But to me, at least it seems like in the last 10, 15 years, it has gotten worse. That the immediately, right, we don't really know anything. We don't know what has happened. But immediately there's different commentators or different media outlets that have a theory that seemingly fits into their own narrative, right? So one of the biggest ones in the beginning was immediately, oh, you know what? Spain actually a few days before this has a ha had a day where it was 100% running on renewable electricity. So it can only be that, right? And it obviously kind of came from the right wing of the spectrum. And then right, the left also had their own theories. And to me, that's really upsetting, is that everything is being politicized all the time, despite not knowing anything yet, right? I mean, as I said, it's May 2nd, and we still don't know what was the real cause. There are some, right, some experts are pointing into the direction of the energy grids, and that there was like a little glitch basically that happened. But that's all we know. However, political commentators have already known enough to politicize this for their own purpose.
I just spent quite a bit of time praising Spain for its social attitudes in life, the way that they handled Monday and the way that people take care of each other. Everyone is friendly. But of course, the other side of Spain as a society is the enormous political tribalism, right? And I would argue that is more so than in Northern Europe, for example. So unfortunately, tribalism is growing everywhere. Right, in the Netherlands as well, in the UK as well, in Germany as well. But Spain has always been politically very tribal, and it basically means that people walk around belonging to either the left or the right or whatever they belong to, and the moment something happens, it must be the group's fault. And even if they don't really think it's the other group's fault, it's the other party's fault, they want to use it to may basically make the others look bad. One of the very clear signs of that was that immediately Sanchez, Prime Minister Sanchez, went into a press conference and immediately started talking about nuclear energy and how nuclear energy wasn't the answer because other people had argued, hey, if we had just had nuclear energy, it was fine. As Prime Minister, it's not your job to engage in these kinds of conversations at this moment. Don't make it into nuclear energy, yay or nay. That is for later. That is a policy question that can be dealt with in the next few months, years. Now, as Prime Minister, you just need to provide the facts, and you don't want to get into petty infighting. But in Spain, it happens automatically. Spanish politicians, as well as the population, automatically jump into that mode of how can I blame the other side? And if I can't, I'm still gonna try. I'm still gonna find a way to somehow make this about something rather than saying, hey, let's have some solidarity. Let's agree that we're all, as everyone in Spain is facing this problem right now. Let's deal with this problem. Let's wait for the experts to come with their verdict. And then based on that, we will come up with some kind of conversations about where do we want to go next with our electricity grid, where do we want to generate our energy from, etc., etc.
I mean, I agree that I think Spain is a bit more politicized than other countries in Europe, and I think that's simply because of the political culture. It is becoming an emerging trend in other European countries as well, or well, even more so than before. Because here, so in Germany, of course, a blackout in Spain, the first question you ask yourself before you ask yourself, is everyone fine? You say, oh, could this happen here too? Right, and it was the exact same discussion, being like, oh, could this happen here too? Are we too reliant on renewables? I'm sorry, but renewables are only 10% of the German overall energy consumption, so we are not reliant on renewables. We're reliant on all the other ones, right? I mean, of course, you might want to have a good mix in between, but if anything, right, renewables are a lot more decentralized than the other ones, so risk actually is a little bit lower. But yeah, that's very frustrating, and it's very like indicative of how the West is at the moment, right? It's this thing of everything is tribal and everything can be used to score a point over another.
Yeah, whereas most of these questions should just be answered by experts, and most people, including myself, for example, should have no opinion on it because I just don't know. So I sent you a message asking after that Sanchez press conference because you know more about energy and all these things than I do. I sent you a message. Hey, do you have any views on this? Well, I sent that on Tuesday because on Monday I couldn't send you any messages. because I don't know. And yet this is not a problem with our world today, right? That everyone, despite not actually knowing anything about these issues, because you're not an expert, you haven't studied it, everyone believes that they can come up with a conclusion, that they can have an opinion on these topics that is basically intuitive, political, and it's got nothing to do with actual understanding of the issues at hand. The one thing, though, because you say that it makes you very upset, is yes, it is frustrating and it's problematic, but there is something much more dangerous here, right? And last week we spoke about war. We spoke about how in countries, for example, in the Netherlands, including the Dutch king, create this vibe, this atmosphere in which we are in a gray area between peace and war, which is incredibly dangerous. That feeds into that narrative of there is an enemy out there. They are our enemy. There's no point talking to them. And at some point, they're going to strike us. So we better be prepared. And probably we should be the ones who strike first, preemptively, right? That kind of atmosphere gets created. Now, when then something unexpected happens, like on Monday, then our reaction therefore becomes very much based on that pre-existing atmosphere, right? So if we had lived in the 1990s and this had happened, nobody would have said this is Russia or this is China, because nobody thought that Russia or China were our enemy. Not in the 90s, not after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So the idea that we immediately jump to erroneous conclusions and the almost belligerent conclusions, oh, we're being attacked, so we have to strike back, is deeply, deeply dangerous. And that leads to a situation where next time something unexpected happens, let's say, I don't know, a big explosion in the center of Madrid or in New York or in London or whatever, that immediately the United States goes to DEFCON 2 and starts preparing its nuclear arsenal to be shot at China or Russia or whatever. That is the kind of world we're creating with this badly analyzed fear-mongering. And we have to be extremely careful, because unexpected things will happen. And when they do, we have to react in the most rational, reasonable way possible.
So after, right, all of this has happened. I mean, we don't know the cause yet. But as you said, unexpected things will continue to happen. My question to you is, are you, or, well, you personally, but also is Spain, well prepared for the next unexpected thing to happen? Like, do you think that there are some lessons we should take from this and basically say, hey, in case something like this happens again, what do we need to improve?
Well, so this is an interesting question, right? It reminds a little bit of COVID. My position, but maybe it's not the right position, is that what happened on Monday and what happened during COVID basically shows that we don't need to prepare too much for things, because it was fine afterwards, right? Now, I could certainly see the value in having a little backpack where you have, you know, like a torch and so on, and some batteries and things like that. Absolutely. And have some radio. Absolutely. Radio was extremely useful, because that doesn't rely on the usual news sources. I have bottles of water in your house, some extra bottles of water in case for a few days there's no water supply. This idea that we all should be preparing for the end times again, though, goes back to what I just said. I would be concerned about that. So to, in a lighthearted way, say, hey, I'm just going to store some extra things in order to make sure that I'm okay for the first few days if something unexpected happens, like Monday, fine. That makes sense. That's reasonable. But let's not become a prepper society, right? Let's not become a society where we're every day prepared for World War III. Because by doing that, by becoming that society, we are actually encouraging World War III. We are mentally preparing for something that we should spend energy on avoiding, right? So the moment you say, oh, I'm prepared for anything that comes, then all of a sudden you're no longer actively trying to avoid that coming to you. So I would be a little bit concerned with those people who now say, oh, okay, I know that in the future the world is, you know, gonna hit me hard, and I am gonna create my little bunker with my cyber truck and everything, and I'm gonna have it all ready so that I don't depend on society. Well, the moment that you say that you're preparing for a world where you don't depend on society is the moment you're no longer investing in society. So let's keep it reasonable and light. That would be my argument here.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on are we ready for the next chaos? If you have any questions, comments, or you want to share your experience with us right from Madrid, we know we have a lot of listeners from Spain, then send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com and we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I thought it would be apt to take a quote from Nikola Tesla, one of course, the founders of our modern electricity grid, AC in particular. And he had this quote that depending on how you interpret it, you could see it as a negative or a positive. I think it's more a warning towards the future, but he probably also saw it as something like to be admired. And the quote goes, "The spread of civilization may be likened to a fire. First, a feeble spark, next, a flickering flame, then, a mighty blaze, ever increasing in speed and power."